KRX, this is the Moth Radio Hour. I'm Meg Bowles. One of the first questions we ask when we meet someone new is, where are you from? Today we'll hear four stories that have some connection to home. Whether searching for a place to call home or running away from one in search of another, there is something in us humans that inherently wants to belong to a place. Many of us can relate to the deep desire to leave our childhood homes behind, hoping to find a place where we feel more in our element, or maybe we simply crave adventure, like our first storyteller. Susie Ronson shared this story of running away with a proverbial circus at a main stage we produced at the Union Chapel in London. The theme of the night was coming home.
Hi, everybody. I was born a few years after World War II and brought up in a nice house in a typical suburb of southeast London, Bromley in Kent. My parents both worked. My father was a long-distance lorry driver, and my mother was a shop assistant. They got married shortly after the war simply because that's what everybody did. The government gave generous allowances, and my brother and I both had free milk at school, a third of a pint in a glass bottle with a silver top. I don't think my parents expected too much of me after school. I think they thought I would kind of grow up, you know, have a bit of fun, get married, and have some children. The swinging 60s kind of changed all of that. I mean, we had the best music in the world. It was a great time to be a teenager. Fabulous fashion and the pill. Twiggy was my fashion model of the day, and everybody wanted to look like her. She was a tall, skinny girl with a flat chest and flat hair, and I wanted to look like her too, but no chance. You know, I was completely out of style. My hair was thick and frizzy, and I couldn't do anything with it. I wore horrible glasses, and I was had waist and hips. You know, I even tried Coca-Cola cans in my hair to try and make it straight, but it didn't really work. I wasn't good at school, I didn't like school. So when I was 15, I went to the Evelyn Paget College of Hair and Beauty in Bromley to study hairdressing. I passed the course and was transferred to the Evelyn Paget School in Beckenham, which is where I met Mrs. Jones. Mrs. Jones was my 2:45 shampoo and set on a Thursday afternoon. Sometimes she would have a little trim and a chocolate kiss rinse, and I think I permed her hair once. As I would do her hair, you know, she would chat to me about her son, David. She would say, you know, he's always been an artist and he sings in a band. And, you know, it was the same kind of conversation week after week, and I would nod and smile. And she would, you know, just, she seemed so proud of him. I didn't really take much notice until one day she mentioned the song Space Oddity. And I looked at her and I said, Space Oddity, you know, I've heard that on the radio. Are we talking about David Bowie? She said, yes, I'm his mum. I mean, who knew? And there was a buzz about David in Beckenham, you know. He played at the Three Tons, albeit folk songs, but he had the hit Space Oddity. I hadn't heard of it, you know, hadn't heard much more from him, so I kind of thought he might be a one-hit wonder. First time I saw David, he's walking down Beckenham High Street in a dress. He's with this girl with skinny black pants on, and I met the girl. Mrs. Jones brought her into the salon. It was Angie, David's wife. You know, and I liked her immediately. She was so cool and fabulous, and she looked so great. I mean, she certainly didn't shop in Beckenham. I heard a bit about her life. She did David's lights, and they used to run around London and go to all the clubs. I mean, it just sounded so glamorous. Didn't see her for a while, and then when she came back, it was Christmas week. She's coming for an appointment Christmas week. I mean, every self-respecting salon in the land is busy Christmas week. So I took her to one side and I said, there's no appointments, darling. Here, take my number, give me a call, I'll come to your house and do your hair. Well, off I went to Haddon Hall, which was the name of their home. It was about a mile out of town, a huge mansion that had been divided into flats, and they had the middle floor. You know, I'm curious. You know, I've heard about her life. I'm kind of curious about the way she lives. So I walked into the house, into this massive living room, which was completely overwhelming. But it wasn't that so much. It was more the way it was decorated. A dark blue carpet, dark blue walls, and a silver ceiling. It was so calm. There wasn't much furniture, a couple of couches, a chair or two, some cushions on the floor, and the rest of the room was completely covered with record albums and musical equipment. David and Angie were sitting by a large bay window, and they were discussing the merits of cutting his hair short. He had this long, blonde, wavy hair at the time. They asked me my opinion. I said, well, you know, no one else has got short hair. You know, nobody. You'd look really different. So he comes over with this magazine cover, and there's this Kansai Yamamoto model, and she's got this short red hair, and he said, can you do that? Well, as I'm saying yes, I'm thinking to myself, it's a woman's hairstyle. And how am I going to actually do that? But inside, you know, I'm excited because this is a time to be creative. I mean, fantastic looking bloke, tall and slim, long white neck and a beautiful face. I thought, if I can pull this off, he's going to look great. So I guess it took me about a half an hour. You know, I chopped his hair off, and after I'd finished, his hair wouldn't stand up. You know, it just kind of flopped. And I'm looking at it, I'm kind of panicking, and I can see he's not looking too happy. So I said, as soon as we tint the hair, it's going to change the texture. You know, it's going to look great, I can promise you. It's going to stand up. I was praying I was right. I went and experimented with colour, and I found the colour, red hot red, with 30 volume procs. I had to give it a bit of a kick. But, you know, there was no product in those days. You know, you didn't have gels or fixatives. There was nothing to help me make it stand up. So I used Guard. It was an anti-dandruff treatment that I'd used on the old girls at the salon that set hair like stone. The second he looked at himself in the mirror with that short red hair, any doubts he had completely disappeared. I mean, Angie and I looked at him in awe. He looked fantastic. He gained a couple of inches with the height. You know, a huge wave of relief washed over me. I'd done it. Standing up, I was so relieved. I'm packing to leave, and she says, well, how much do we owe you? I said, oh, £2, please. They called me, and I went up to see them at a place in London. The band were playing, and I went to see them. And I still wasn't sure what kind of a following he had. You know, he played folk music. I wasn't quite sure. I walked in. The place is packed. It's a college. The kids are about my age, but they're not like me. I mean, they're well-educated, everything that I wasn't. Lights went down, some music came on, and the band took to the stage, and it was a real, oh my God, moment for me. I mean, David was Ziggy Stardust. He had full makeup on, his hair was flaming on his head. They all wore costumes. The band had this kind of flat velvet pastel color suits tucked into their boots. And David had a similar kind of a look on. And when they played, I mean, the place rocked. They were so good. This wasn't folk music, that's for sure. They were amazing. What a great band. I went home thinking to myself, well, my God, I didn't expect to see that. Angie called me and said, come to the house. You know, we'd like to talk to you. So I went up to Haddon Hall, and Freddie Beretti was there. Now, Freddie had helped design the costumes with David. I went up, and he was so fey and fabulous. You know, I was entranced, his mannerisms, the way he talked. I mean, he was fantastic, Freddie. I'd never met a gay man before. At some point during that evening, David leans over and kisses Freddie full on the mouth. Well, I didn't know which way to look. You know, I kind of looked at Angie, and she's laughing, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm completely out of my league here, you know. I wasn't like these people. I didn't know who Nietzsche was. I'd never heard of Lou Reed. I certainly didn't know who Andy Warhol was. I'd never seen guys kissing before. I was from Beckenham. Angie takes me to one side later that evening and says, you know, David and I have decided we want you to come on the road with us. So you're to go tomorrow to Maymen offices in London and discuss your wages with Tony DeFries, David's manager. So the next day, I go up to the offices in London, heart in hand, and I talk to Tony, and by the end of the afternoon, I've got the job. I'm driving home, and it's suddenly sinking in. You know, I'm going to go on the road with a rock and roll band. I mean, it's like a dream come true. I couldn't believe it. I went to Evelyn Paget's the next day and gave him my notice. And my boss said to me, he said, you know, Suzanne, you should think carefully before you give up a well-paying, secure job. I looked at him and said, yes, I have. After this, of course, my confidence knew no bounds because I've done David's hair. So I met the band at the flat and I cut Woody's hair, the drummer, who was a bit like a short blonde Bowie, and I cut Trevor's hair off and sprayed his sideburns silver. The only holdout was Mick Ronson. He didn't want to look like David. So then I started on the road with them, and we even did Top of the Pops. David, they played Starman, and during the chorus, David draped his arm around Mick Ronson's shoulders. I think it shook Britain to the core. You know, certainly shook my mum and dad. It was great. After David was always so ambitious, you know, he wanted to do rock and roll theatre. So we started the Finsbury Park, the Rainbow Theatre. We were there like 18-hour days. There was scaffolding and mime artists, dried ice and fantastic lights. I mean, it was an amazing show. We were all sworn to secrecy. No press, no cameras, no nothing. But we made such a big deal of it, and it made the show so appealing. By the time it opened, everybody came. And I think the only person that didn't like it was Elton John. You know, he walked out halfway through saying, "That's not rock and roll, he's never going to make it now." Well, I could feel the momentum gathering, you know. We're driving around the country in a bus and fans were following us, and it was a really great time. Everything was going so well. I was with David all the time throughout that period. You know, I would be with him before the show, doing his hair, his costumes, getting everything he wanted. I was kind of his personal as well as his hairdresser. And, you know, we did many costume changes, and one was doing a guitar solo. I mean, he would come to the side of the stage, I would have a jeton cigarette and a glass of wine, and he would take them and I would change them while Mickey's wailing like 10 seconds from 10 feet from where we were. It was exciting, but we had it down to an art. We went to America and we really traveled in style in the States. You know, we stayed at the Plaza Hotel in New York and the Beverly Hills in California. We were in Ziggy's world and no one wanted to go anywhere else. I mean, I never wanted to go home. We had a great ahead team. This group would go ahead of us to a different town. It was Cherry Vanilla, famous groupie, and Lee Black Childers of Warhol fame. And they would go into a town and they'd go to the clubs and create a big fuss and get the people to come to the gigs. And it was very successful. I went to, I met Iggy Pop in California. We went to the Beverly Hills Hotel and he said, "I want you to dye my hair blue." I said, "Okay." So I dyed his hair blue and I said, "You know, you might want to wash it a couple of times before you go back in the pool." Well, of course. Of course, he completely ignored me and dived in the pool, and there was a blue streak from one end of the other at the Beverly Hills Hotel pool, and I think he was asked to leave after that. I even went to Japan with David, you know, and I met Kansai Yamamoto and picked up some fantastic costumes of his. It was great being in Japan. I mean, I was being noticed suddenly. I was suddenly cool. You know, everybody kind of wanted to know me. The girl with the thick hair and the glasses, you know, suddenly had become the one to be. I went back home after one of these tours. I walked down Beckenham High Street. I looked in the window of Evelyn Paget's. My God, it looked so small. Thank my lucky stars I wasn't there anymore. You know, Beckenham hadn't changed. My family hadn't changed, but I'd changed so much. I was a million miles from where I'd been before. The last show that David ever did was at Hammersmith Odeon. And he just stood on the stage and said, "This is the last show we're ever going to do," and played Rock and Roll Suicide. And I was sad to say goodbye to Ziggy. I think we were all sad to say goodbye to Ziggy. But I didn't go home. I mean, I went to Italy and fell in love with Mick Ronson, the guitar player, and moved in with him to London. And it was a great ending for me. And I am thankful for my luck. You know, I'm so grateful that I met Mrs. Jones and Angie. So grateful I gave him my telephone number, otherwise somebody else might have lived my life. Thrilled that I met and married the guitar player, the late, great Mick Ronson, and had a beautiful daughter with him. I met so many interesting people throughout that time, you know, and heard so much wonderful music. I'm so grateful for David for taking a chance on me and taking me on the road with him. My haircut's on British currency now, the Brixton £10 note. Who would have thought I could have done that? Thank you.
These days, Susie Ronson lives in New York City. She's working on a book about her experiences touring with both David Bowie and Lou Reed. The rest of her family, including her daughter, the singer-songwriter Lisa Ronson, live in London. Susie says she swears someday she'll go home for good.
Ground control to Major Tom.
Coming up, two stories of how heartbreak can sometimes force us to reevaluate our relationship to home when the Moth Radio Hour continues.
Take your protein pills and put your helmet on.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX.
It's time to leave the capsule if you dare. This is Major Tom to ground control. I'm stepping through the door and I'm floating in a most peculiar way. Now the stars look very different today.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Meg Bowles. Just when our next storyteller, Dennis Rep, started to feel like he was putting down some roots, things suddenly shifted. He shared his experience at an open mic story slam we produced in Pittsburgh, where we partner with public radio station WESA. Here's Dennis Rep live at the Moth.
So it was about a year ago that my girlfriend broke up with me. In hindsight, she did the right thing, but I didn't see it coming. So it left me kind of off balance for a few weeks. For one thing, when you have a breakup at this time of year, I had already started some Christmas shopping. She had let me know some things she wanted. She wanted a fancy fleece blanket, for example, and I already got that. It was in my living room waiting to be wrapped, and now, being who I am, I had already lost my receipt, so I couldn't really return it. So my first inclination was just to actually give it to her and be done with it. I asked my friends at my bar about that, and it was a unanimous response, don't you dare give that to her. Find anything else to do with it, but don't give it to her. So I didn't. I had been accustomed to going to her house a lot and helping with the house and helping with her and taking people to dance class and helping with homework, and now I had none of that to do. And so I had a lot of time on my hands. So I spent a few weeks doing a lot of nothing until a friend at work suggested I needed to do something, and I needed to maybe volunteer somewhere. And she suggested a dog shelter near my house. And it sounded good to me. I like dogs. I certainly had the time. So let's try that. So I became a dog walker at a shelter near my place. When you do that, you commit to go an hour a week. With the state of my life, I was going 5 or 6 days a week, at least an hour a day, walking several dogs, just walking them, giving them a little break, getting them out of the shelter, exercising them, trying to get them ready to go home with somebody. Now, at our shelter, the average dog stays there for about 56 days from the time it comes in till someone takes them home. Now, that includes the dogs that come in, runaways, you know, just got and broke off the chain. Their owner comes for them a day or two later. So at the other end of the spectrum is the hard cases, the guys who have been there for a long time, including a dog named Lake. All we knew about Lake was that he was about 2 years old. He was found at a county park running near a lake, which is how they named him. And Lake just could not catch a break. He was a gorgeous dog, really very smart, but he had some stranger danger. And so his first response on seeing a man was to try to attack him. And Lake's the kind of dog, you look at him, people think he's a pit bull. He's not, but he certainly has some terrier in him. He liked women, he liked kids, but a guy would see him or he would see the guy, and he would not get a second look. Because when you're looking to adopt a dog, you don't want your first interaction with a dog to be, the dog's trying to kill me. So he never got a second look. So Lake was there for weeks and then months and then years. Lake was at that shelter for over 2 years. around the time I started walking, he'd been there a year and a half, and I got the same response. The first time he saw me, he was trying to kill me. He got better. A steady stream of treats calmed him down. And eventually my walking skills got to the point where I was allowed to walk him, and we were great. He was one of our favorites. He was everybody's favorite, everyone who worked there, anyone who knew him, and all the staff, any volunteer who knew him loved this dog, and we just wanted to get him home with somebody. Well, you can see where this is going. I was getting toward the end of a long home improvement project, and as it was coming toward the end, I decided when it was over, I was ready to take someone home and it was going to be Lake. So I put my name in and they approved me. Now there is at the shelter, there's a whiteboard in the office where they put the names of all the dogs that are coming and going. So we know Opie has a meet and greet next week and Chance is going home and Iris is at the vet. And so people just know. And then the day Lake's name went up there, I'm told that anyone who came into the office cried, including me. Well, the day came to take him home. It was a big day. A lot of the staff came. Volunteers came just to see him off, and they all brought their cameras with them. So there are pictures of Lake walking out of that shelter for the last time and going to his car. And there's a picture of him in the back seat of my car, in his seat, looking out the window, and I swear that dog is smiling. There's a picture a short time later in his new yard for the first time, by himself, his own yard. Not as big as the yard he left behind at the shelter, but this one's all his. There's another picture of me on one knee with Lake's face in mine, and we're facing away from the camera. He's giving me a big dog hug. And with her looking away, so you can't see the tongue bath he's giving me. And you can't see the tears on my face. Everyone who overlooked him for 2 years, they're all suckers. And one more thing, the blanket I never gave to my girlfriend, Lake finds it very comfortable.
Dennis Rep still volunteers at the shelter twice a week. He says Lake is doing great. He sent in some pictures, and in every one, Lake has the most enormous grin. Dennis says his home is a little bit of a disaster with the combination of bachelor and dog who likes to chew up his toys. So any potential new romances will have to love Lake and be forgiving of the mess. Back in 2012, it was reported that Jonah Lehrer had fabricated quotes attributed to Bob Dylan in a book he had published about creativity. What followed was a close scrutiny of his previous work, where it was determined that in addition to these made-up quotes, he had reused his own writing across various media platforms. He ended up losing his position as a staff writer with The New Yorker, two of his books were recalled, and his career as a journalist basically came to a halt. A lot has been written about Jonah's fall from grace. There are a lot of opinions about the mistakes he made, judgments about his character, and about the public shaming that ensued. When I spoke to Jonah about telling a story, I was less interested in the details of what happened. That story had been told a million times over. I was more interested in what happens to someone who's at the top of their game, a sought-after writer touring around the country speaking to large crowds, contributing to various publications and radio programs. What happens when that wave of success crashes and there are no more invitations or accolades? Jonah shared his story about the days following these events at a Los Angeles main stage presented by public radio station KCRW. Here's Jonah Lehrer live at the Moth.
It was late at night. I was standing outside my house. I had just driven in from the airport. I was always driving in from the airport. And I remember staring at the front door, knowing that once I opened it, my life would never be the same again. That morning, I'd been in St. Louis giving a talk to 1,000 people at the convention center. Right before I step on stage, I get a call. I learn that another writer has discovered that I'd fabricated several Bob Dylan quotes in one of my books. I'd been a lifelong Dylan fan and was familiar with approximate versions of what he'd said. So I put in those approximations to make it sound better, as if I'd actually done my homework. And then I forgot they were there. These fabrications weren't the only mistakes in my work. They were simply the worst. There is no excuse for what I've done, for breaking the most basic rule of journalism: don't make shit up. Instead, all I've got is a long list of regrets about the kind of writer I'd become. I was driven by a mixture of insecurity and ambition. No matter how high I got, and I got really lucky really fast, I was convinced it would all disappear, that I had to grab the chance and the checks while I could. So I said yes to everything: columns, blogs, books, articles, talks. Instead of focusing on the difficult pleasures of writing, checking and rechecking my work, I judged myself by the superficial markers of success: the sound of applause in a hotel conference room, my Amazon sales ranking, an inbox full of invitations. And then it all fell apart. I got that call backstage, and I knew right away that my career was over. People talk about public shame, about all the mean people on the internet. And it's true, there are mean people on the internet. But for me, and I can only speak to my own experience here, the private shame is so much worse. I can turn off my phone. I can't turn off those thoughts about how I hurt the people I'm closest to, those I most respect. Those are the thoughts I'm going to be wrestling with for the rest of my life. Above all, I think about my wife. I opened the door, and there she was, sitting on the couch in a ponytail and her pajamas. I called from the airport telling her I was coming home early, that I had terrible news, but now I had to give her all the sordid details. I remember the way she listened and tried not to cry. I told her that night to leave me, that I wasn't worthy of her and never would be, that I would be sad for a long time, and she deserved so much better. But she stayed. And because she stayed, I have a story to tell. The transition was sudden. I went from living a very busy life full of deadlines to one in which I had nothing at all to do. But I did have a young daughter, which meant that I was stuck with childcare by the process of elimination. And the sad truth was that up to that point, I'd been a bad father. I was always gone on the road more than I was home. And when I was home, I was always staring at a screen, which is probably why my daughter said apple long before she said dada. In fact, for the first 16 months of my daughter's life, I never put her to sleep. Not once, not even for naps. But now I was home, eager to make up for lost time, and I decided that parenthood would be my consolation. I would use my failure to become a better father to my young daughter. Of course, I settled on this narrative for all the wrong reasons. I chose it mostly because it sounded like something I should say. The appropriate turn in the movie version of my life: failed writer becomes devoted family man, disgraced author turns into dad of the year. That at least was how I imagined it. One night early on, my wife had to work late, which meant that I had to put my daughter to bed by myself. Said it was fine, not a problem. I knew what to do. I carefully repeated her bedtime ritual. There was Sesame Street and a glass of milk, followed by a long procession of books in bed. But nothing worked. She just kept asking for her mother. I begged, I pleaded. I read more books, I sang songs. I tried lying down on the floor next to her crib, but she didn't care. Why would she? Who was I? Where had I been? And then when I felt my own anger welling up inside, because kids, they can make you so angry, I exiled myself to the hallway. I sat there outside her door, and I listened to my daughter very slowly cry herself to sleep. I sat there, and for the first time since everything had happened, I started crying too. Years later, this is a memory that still makes me ache, that makes my chest all tight and hollow. Because it was there, in that hallway, that I finally felt the full scope of my mistakes. I wanted my daughter to be my redemption, my consolation, and she wanted nothing at all to do with me. And those were just the nights. The days were just as difficult and endless seeming. Doesn't help that two-year-olds tell the truth. My daughter wasn't afraid of pointing out all my errors. And when she complained because I was doing it wrong, because I let the sunblock get in her eye or put her diaper on backwards again, I would get sad and furious, which only made me feel worse. This wasn't how the movie was supposed to go. In the movie, my daughter never swallows a penny. In the movie, I don't have to spend the next week searching through her dirty diapers, looking for a coin I never did find. But children are forgiving, and I kept showing up because I had nowhere else to be. One day, about a year into my adventure in fatherhood, my daughter invented a new game for us to play. At the time, she was deep into Doc McStuffins, that Disney cartoon about the little girl who takes care of her sick toys. She decided that she was going to be Doc, which meant that I was going to be the sick toy. She told me to lie down and began looking over my limbs, asking for a medical history of every scar and bruise. Here is where I fell down and cut my knee and got stitches. Here is where I banged my shin into the car door. I broke this finger playing basketball, which is why it's still crooked. Then she'd get out her little plastic doctor kit and with the patience I didn't know she had, tend to all my wounds. At the end of a session, I'd be covered in Band-Aids, gauze, and scotch tape. We played the doctor game every day for months. I thought I was taking care of my child, but really, she was taking care of me. When I look back on these last few years with my daughter and now my toddler son, the days I felt closest to them have often been the most difficult ones. Not the filtered portraits you share on Instagram, but the night when the kid pukes on you in your bed at 2 a.m., or when the afternoon has dissolved into a series of crying fits about no more gummy vitamins, and this is the last book, really it is, and yes, you have to brush your teeth. Do you not remember eating all those gummy vitamins? They are those moments when you realize that this whole situation only exists, that you are putting up with the fights and the exhaustion and the boredom and the boogers because you love them beyond words. I don't want to make it sound like I'm raising these kids by myself when the reality is my wife still does most of the work. And I don't want to pretend that getting to spend the afternoon playing Harry Potter and searching for Goldbug means I don't sometimes miss the sound of applause. There are still so many days when I wish I could disappear my sins, purge my Google results, travel back in time, and just do it all over again. But I also know that the worst parts, those scenes I most want to forget, they're also the most important parts. The look on the face of my wife when I tell her what I've done, the sound of my daughter crying in the hallway because I provide no comfort at all. There's a line from the Sufi mystic Inayat Khan, "God breaks the heart again and again and again until it stays open." That's what happened to me. The best days for me now are when the happiness catches me by surprise. The joy it gives my son to watch the tire guys at Costco. The dance party to Beyonce that's interrupted when I realize my daughter knows way too many of the words to Drunken Love. That moment in every meal where things get so messy, you stop noticing the mess and just enjoy the sight of a hungry kid smearing peanut butter into his hair. Such is family life. Sometimes you can't believe who you've become or what you're laughing at or where you most want to be. Our attachments bend us in funny ways. I'm grateful that I got bent. I learned about love. My family taught me about love. And that has been my great consolation. Thank you.
That was Jonah Lehrer. Jonah lives in Los Angeles with his wife and two kids. In addition to acting out Harry Potter scenes and pushing around Hot Wheels, his kids still love watching the Costco tire guys. Jonah continues to write. His most recent endeavor is a book about the science of attachment theory. He says writing is the way he thinks through things, how he wrestles with ideas and makes sense of himself and the world. You can find out more about Jonah and the other storytellers featured in this hour by visiting our website, themoth.org. Coming up, a woman walks the entire eastern continent of Africa in search of a place to call home when the Moth Radio Hour continues.
Support for The Moth comes from Constant Contact. With live coaching, email marketing features such as drag and drop editing, and social media tools, Constant Contact is committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits become marketers. More at ConstantContact.com. The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Meg Bowles, and our last story comes from Abin Kucha. We first met Abin when she called the Moth pitch line. She left a two-minute pitch about her experiences in a refugee camp in Africa. When I spoke with Abin, she regaled me with stories of what it was like for her when she came to America, how out of her element she truly was. She told her story at a main stage we produced in Portland, Maine, the first place Abin called home in the United States. Here's Abin Kucha, live at the Moth.
When I first arrived in Portland, Maine, I walked off the plane with my 12-year-old brother and my 8-year-old daughter and my two little boys, 4 years old and 2 years old. The woman from social services who met us took us directly to this room with the conveyor belt. I had never seen anything like it before. We stood there in silence, washing the bags. And she asked me, "Do you see your bag?" And I told her I didn't have a bag. Only this plastic bag I was carrying, that's all we had. And she said, "Right. Okay. Well, then let's go home." And that word, home, I hadn't had a home since my village. I was born in a small village called Bor in South Sudan. We knew Africa had its troubles, but we had food and we had each other. Until one day, the spring after I graduated from high school, I was in the market getting meat for my family. Baskets were raised, and people were shouting. The meat wouldn't go far, and we all wanted some. Over the noise and chaos, the unmistakable sound of gunfire filled the air. Some people dropped to the ground, and some people ran. I chose to run. My stepmother and I grabbed what we could and ran into the jungle and on to another village. It would be 11 years until I stopped running from that war. I never know peace in Africa again. Later, I met my husband. All my children were born in refugee camps. Later, things changed from bad to worse. My husband was killed in the war, and I lost my second daughter. She died of starvation and disease, and we were wandering from place to place. So when this woman said, "Let's go home," there was nothing else I wanted. She brought us to an apartment. We had never been in an apartment before. We had lived with thousands of other refugees wandering from under the tree to under the tree. So this apartment was different to us. She showed us around the apartment. I remembered when she opened the refrigerator full of food, but there was nothing familiar with us. We saw a big bottle of orange soda, and we thought it was juice. So we tasted it, and it tasted very bad. So we left it. She showed us the bathroom and the shower. She showed us everything. But before she left, she said, "This is a fire alarm. When you hear it, just go. Go outside and wait there until it's all clear." Then she left. And all five of us were standing in this strange place, very scary. I told the kids, "Let's sit down. We are home now." I kept remembering the word home. I said we should really sit down. There were two couches in the living room. My children had never seen a couch before or a carpet. So I went to the kitchen to warm up some milk. But before we drank our warm milk, we heard a noise. And I told the kids, "Let's run. That's the fire alarm the woman was talking about." Back in refugee camps, we had a plan, because one time the village was attacked, and I had to run with the children, and it was very difficult for me to collect all of them. So we made a plan that when something happened, my brother would grab the baby, and I would grab my four-year-old, and my daughter would held my skirt, and we ran. So here we were in Portland, Maine, in this apartment, hearing this noise. So we went into our plan, and my brother grabbed the baby. I grabbed my 4 years old. My daughter held my dress, and we ran out of the apartment. We stood there. And I asked them, "Do you see the fire? Do you smell the smoke?" They said no. So I said, we stood there for a while, and we said, "We should probably go back inside the building." So we walked inside the building slowly. But we didn't know which one was our apartment. We looked, but all the doors look alike. We tried few of them, but they were locked. Later, I saw one door a little bit open. So we thought, this might be our apartment. I went in first, slowly. And it was our apartment. There was a woman standing by the door. She told us she accidentally rang a doorbell. So we learned it wasn't a fire alarm at all. It was a doorbell. The woman from social services would come to visit us from time to time. And when she usually come, she would always find me sleeping. So one day she asked me, "Why do you sleep so much?" And I told her, for the last 8 years, I worked from Sudan to Ethiopia. And I worked again from Ethiopia to Sudan. And again from Sudan to Kenya. And from Kenya to the border of Somalia. I worked from under the tree to under the tree. From hunger to hunger. From gunfire to gunfire. From death to death. I worked the entire eastern continent of Eastern Africa with these children. I am sleeping because I hadn't slept for 8 years. Portland was different with my village. My village was a small village. It lies on the eastern bank of White Nile, with maybe around 5,000 people. My father had 4 wives as a custom in my village. I lived among many brothers and sisters. I went to school and learned English, my third language. I was happy. But in Maine, we felt so alone. We were feeling alone. So I asked for some friends somewhere, especially people from my tribe. A woman helped me to find some friends who made it to Minnesota. So with the help of social services, we were able to move to Minnesota. In Minnesota, my children had their first opportunity to go to school. I managed to enroll them in a school. I bought them school clothes and supplies they needed. The woman who helped me told me that the kids would need to wake up early in the morning and go to the bus stop, school bus. So she told me that we would need an alarm clock. So I went to Kmart and I asked the ladies there if they had an alarm clock sounded like a rooster. They helped me found one. We set the alarm clock in the morning. The kids wake up. I woke my 12-year-old brother and my 8-year-old daughter. I woke them to the bus stop. The bus stop was just behind our apartment. I watched them climbing onto the bus with tears in my eyes. The bus took off. Parents left. I was still standing there with tears in my eyes, wondering if they would come back, hoping they would come back to me. Later, I went back to the apartment to my little boys. They were still sleeping. My tears were still falling. I thought about everything my children had gone through, everything they had seen. When my baby, Jock, was born, the village was attacked. After nine hours after his birth, I was forced to live with him. And now, we made it. My children would never walk 200 miles again. They would never starve again. And they will always be happy, even when I'm not around. Once again, I thought about last few years when my daughter graduated from law school. I was very so proud of all my children. Today, I think about that first day in Portland, Maine airport, when the woman said, let's go home. And home mean hope to me. Home mean I would never, ever run again. Thank you.
Abdan Kuchik came to America in 1994, long before the well-publicized Lost Boys of the Sudan. She says people in her village call her the first cow, because in Sudan, when they travel cattle across the dangerous rivers, they send one cow over first to see if it would be eaten by the crocodiles, to see if the path was safe for the others to follow. Abin has one son who was born in the U.S. The family calls him the American boy. She told me he once called her from a nearby rec center a few blocks from their home, and he said, Mom, come pick me up. And she said, no, you can walk. But he insisted, and she finally said, I walked from Ethiopia to Sudan and back again. You can walk. And he said, but Mom, you didn't have a choice. And to that, Abin responded, neither do you. If you would like to hear more about Abin, Casey Donahue, who oversees the Moth Pitch Line, recently did an interview with her where they talk a lot about the differences between life in America and life in the Sudan. You can find that interview on our website, themoth.org. That's it for this episode. We hope you'll join us again next time for the Moth Radio Hour.
Your host this hour was Meg Bowles. Meg also directed the stories in the show. The rest of the Moth's directorial staff includes Catherine Burns, Sarah Haberman, Sarah Austin Jeunesse, and Jennifer Hickson. Production support from Timothy Lou Lee. Moth stories are true, as remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Most Moth events are recorded by Argo Studios in New York City, supervised by Paul Ruest. Our theme music is by The Drift. Other music in this hour from David Bowie, Stellwagen Symphonette, This Will Destroy You, and Regina Carter. You can find links to all the music we use at our website. The Moth is produced for radio by me, Jay Allison, with Vicki Merrick at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. This hour was produced with funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. The Moth Radio Hour is presented by PRX. For more about our podcast, for information on pitching us your own story, and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org.